I'd like to begin today by reading a passage from Romans 12:3, one that's familiar to all of us, I'm sure. For by the grace given to me, I bid every one of you, or every one among you, to think of himself, to not think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think with sober judgment, each according to the measure of faith which God has assigned him. For as in one body we have many members, and all the members do not have the same function, so we, though many, are one body in Christ, and individually members one of another, having gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, let us use them. Prophecy in proportion to our faith, if service in our serving, she who teaches in her teaching, he who exhorts in his exhortation, she who contributes in liberality, he who gives aid with zeal, she who does acts of mercy with cheerfulness. Let's bow our heads in a word of prayer, shall we? Gracious God, we are grateful for the many differing ways in which you have gifted us as human beings. We are thankful for this specialness that you have bestowed upon each and every person. Lord, we pray that we may learn to use that specialness, that giftedness, for your glory. Amen. And today, what I would like to do is talk just a little bit about the contribution of the psychologist Carl Jung to our own personal understanding of how we are gifted, and how that giftedness can be put to service in terms of finding a spirituality or a way of journeying spiritually that is in harmony with who we are. I have thought about this session since this weekend. Barb asked me on the weekend if I would do something. And the subject of Jung's contribution is such a huge one that it's difficult to kind of narrow it and talk about something that might be helpful to you. And so last night, particularly in listening to our forum and our discussion around the issue of Abba Ima, I began to think about how many of us respond differently to an issue like that, and I think one of the reasons we respond differently is because we're different personalities. Not only because we have different convictions, but because we have different personalities. So we literally see the world differently and experience the world differently, even though we're all members of the human family. And Jung can help us understand some of those differences. Jung, just a word about Carl Jung. Jung was born in approximately 1875, I think, died in 1961. He was born to a Swiss Reformed minister in Switzerland, and did a majority of his work in Switzerland, and ultimately died in a little village of Küsnacht outside of Zurich in the year 1961, and is buried there in the church graveyard. In his early years, he first was a medical student and then became a psychiatrist, and began to be interested in why people behave the way they do in non-conscious ways, why certain things seem to captivate them, and they would act out of unconscious forces. And he was the one who really developed the whole notion of the complex. We all know that word. That's become a popular word in our society. We say so-and-so, or I have such-and-such a complex. an inferiority complex, or we may have experienced some kind of phobia in our life, like claustrophobia or agoraphobia or fear of black cats or whatever. And so we're aware that we're suddenly going along in life and all of a sudden we're reacting in ways, not because we thought about reacting, but we're just simply reacting. Anyway, it was at that point in his life that he met Sigmund Freud. And Freud was an older man and really the founder of the whole psychoanalytic movement in Europe. And Jung really became his student and ultimately heir apparent to the whole psychoanalytic leadership and movement in Europe. But Freud and Jung had a splitting of the ways, and it was largely over religious questions. It was also largely over their understanding of what was going on in the unconscious. And both Jung and Freud agreed that they had different ways of understanding this. But just to make it simple, they agreed that there was, in the personality, that there was a conscious side to the personality, that which we know about ourselves, we're aware of, our thoughts, our feelings, our sensations, and so forth. But that there was a lot about each one of us that we didn't know that shaped who we are. And so we have consciousness, and Jung's term, the unconscious. Freud called this the subconscious. And Freud's understanding of the subconscious and Jung's understanding of the unconscious are two totally different things. The words are not at all interchangeable, although we use them interchangeably in our language. What Freud meant by the subconscious and what Jung meant by the unconscious are two radically different things. Freud, again to state this in an oversimplified way, saw the subconscious as full of stuff that came largely from consciousness that was repressed into the subconscious. That's why I call it a subconscious. And this is an unfair statement, but I've often said that for Freud, the subconscious was a glory hole of repressed desires. it's a lot more complicated than that. But for Jung, the unconscious was a world of its own. That had its own life, and it was full of great dramas and stories, and it had valleys and peaks, and it had hairy-toed creatures like Tolkien writes about running around. And there are many forces that and themes and motifs that impact the unconscious and thus, in turn, shape us as human beings. And the stuff of the unconscious, Jung called complexes. These complexes are big and small and all different sizes, and they create all kinds of interesting stories and dramas that get lived out in our conscious lives. So at one point, Jung wanted to call the psychology that he was working on complex psychology. That's what he called it early on. Only later on did it become known as analytic psychology, which is what it's known as today. Jung, the psychology of C.G. Jung is known as analytic psychology, in, again, distinction from psychoanalytic psychology, which is a term that goes back to Sigmund Freud. Anyway, at the center of these complexes are themes and motifs that Jung called archetypes, archetypes. And these motifs transcend the individual and are shared by human beings all over the globe. So the same themes show up in all of us, but we personalize them with our personal complexes, our own personal stuff and experiences of our lives and so forth. And so Jung said that the unconscious has a transcendent dimension to it. At the very center of the human psyche was a concept that Jung called the self, S-E-L-F. And Jung called that the image of God, not God, but the image of God. And it's kind of the organizing principle. It's what also Jung called the religious function in the psyche. And he said that the self has a forward-going, a forward-moving function to it. It wants the person to develop. It wants the person to develop. And it's over this whole scheme that Jung and Freud broke, because Jung saw what he said it was an empirical fact, what he called the religious dimension of the unconscious was an empirical fact from his point of view. He said, now I'm speaking as a scientist, not as a metaphysician. He said, there is a function in the unconscious that I have observed in the thousands of patients and clients that I have worked with that wants for the person a more complete, a more whole existence. Freud could not agree with that. And so they went their separate ways. So the psyche, in Jung's terms, in all of its complexity, was the bridge between what we know consciously and our own spiritual life. Now, how did consciousness function for Jung? How do we function so that we can get in touch with what's going on in the unconscious? How can we get in touch with the movement of God within us and in between us? How can we get in touch with the movement of God in creation? How can we get in touch with God in many different ways? And that issue relates to how Jung understood how our conscious side functions. Jung did most of his work on the unconscious. And so, as his critics would appropriately say, he was an unconscious psychologist. Most psychology today is focused on the conscious side of the personality. Most of the popular psychologies that most of us learn about and are impacted by are conscious psychologies. They've not functioned intensely like Jung did on the nature and the structure of the unconscious psyche, part of the psyche. Anyway, if we're talking about, so Jung was kind of forced into Adler, and others said, you've got to develop your own, you know, perspective on what's going on in the conscious side of the personality. So Jung said, okay, and he said, I have some hunches about that. Also, I should say that Jung, kind of like Martin Luther, was not a systematic theoretist. He made observations. At the end of his life, he said, I've made some observations, and the whole thing could be overturned, but I offer them to you for what they're worth. And it's really been those that have come after that have been interested in his theories, you might say, and observations about the human psyche that have developed a lot of these issues further. Anyway, as Jung looked at how we function consciously, he said, it seems to me that there are two basic attitudes, and everyone will prefer one or the other. It's like we have two arms or two hands, we have a right hand and a left hand. You can use them both, and you do use them both, but you tend to prefer one or over the other. And the two basic attitudes
are these: extrovert and introvert.
I'll read you some more about these in a moment, but basically the extrovert prefers to pay attention to what's going on outside of them, and that tends to shape how they're thinking and feeling and so forth. It doesn't mean they're necessarily the life of the party. Introverts can be the life of the party. And introverts can be can have a lot of social skills, but an extrovert's preference is to see what's going on out here as they think about issues and problems and decisions and what they like and what they don't like and what's true and what isn't true and so forth. An introvert prefers to look inside themselves to find out what they like and what they don't like and discern what's true and what isn't true and make connections for themselves and so forth. If some of you have observed me in a social setting, you might think I'm an extrovert, but I'm a very strong introvert that's learned, because I've been a pastor all my days, a lot of extroverted kinds of skills. But given my choices, you'll suddenly discover I've disappeared and you won't be able to find me anywhere. To get my battery charged up, I have to go spend time by myself. Extroverts, to get their batteries charged up, usually need to go find somebody else. And that's what gets them going and gets them energized, and so on and so forth. Jung said you can be thinking about yourself too. How many of you have taken the Myers-Briggs type inventory? Oh my goodness, well, you know all this. Jung did not develop the Myers-Briggs type inventory. We'll get into that, but it's built on Jung's theory. Then he said, there are four basic functions that we all have, in addition to two basic attitudes, and they come in pairs. Sensation and intuition. And these he called he called these the non-rational functions, and these two functions tell us how we perceive something, how we make connections for ourselves, how we decide what this is how we decide, but how we take in information. A sensation person, of course, prefers to use the sensing skills like hearing, feeling, touch, taste, smell. What else am I forgetting?
Sight.
What?
Sight.
Sight, right. And the intuitive person likes to look inside themselves more in a very non-rational way to intuit what the truth of a situation is, or what is going on, or what is connected. How are one thing connected to another, and that sort of thing. And so, that's just a brief word about N and S. I'll read you some larger descriptions here in a minute. Then there's one other pair, and that's thinking and feeling.
And interestingly enough, Jung called these the rational functions. He said that's how we use one of these to decide. This is how we know something, and this is how we decide about something, whether it's good or it's bad, right or wrong, and so forth. A thinking person will want to make clear connections and work out of principles and ideas and so forth. A feeling person will judge something being good or bad based on how they feel about it. It kind of comes to them, whether they like something or not. And it isn't a question of it being logical or illogical. It's a question of how they feel about it. So you can have these wonderful, T and S can have these wonderful arguments on, like, what color should we paint the room? And one person will say, well, it's logical that we would paint it such and such a color, that's more utilitarian. The light will, there'll be more light in the room if we paint it this color. And then this person will say, I don't care, I don't like it. What the color I like is. And I'll bet many of you couples have had arguments like that. And so that was Jung's basic understanding of how we function consciously. And there was the two women, a mother-daughter team, Myers and Briggs, that got a hold of this idea and had been working similarly on psychological times. And they added two more letters to it. They added two more attitudes, J and P. Judging and perception, and said that there's two more attitudes that people have a preference for. The J person prefers to organize their world and so that things are predictable, and the P person prefers more spontaneity and open-endedness in their world. A good P person arrives at the airport with an hour and 30 minutes before their next plane and says, boy, I can see my friend who's 45 minutes away and get back in time for the plane. And the J person says, oh, no, no. We're going to sit here and wait and not miss the plane. I drive my wife crazy because I have to be at the airport an hour and a half before the plane leaves. And she'd like to come in the last minute. So, let's see. Let me just read you some more. About some of these categories here. First of all, in terms of the function, a person with a sensing preference will be interested in building. They'll be interested in what's going on in the environment around them and practical matters. Well, let's see. I think maybe what I want to do is read for you. Okay, I thought this was kind of a clever. This comes from a book called Type Talk. It says, if you are an extrovert, and if you haven't taken the Myers-Briggs, you can kind of listen to this and see where you think you fit. If you are an extrovert, you probably tend to talk first, think later, and don't know what you'll say until you hear yourself say it.
It's not uncommon for you to berate yourself with something like, will I ever learn to keep my mouth shut after you have spoken? Extroverts tend to talk and think at the same time. Introverts tend to think and then talk. My family carries on conversations between the time they ask me a question and the time I respond. As opposed to other members of my family who kind of work out what it is they're thinking about by talking about it. Extroverts tend to know a lot of people and count many of them among your close friends. You like to include as many people as possible in your activities. An extrovert doesn't mind reading or having a conversation while a TV or radio is on in the background. In fact, you may well be oblivious to this distraction. Now, some of this may not fit either. You have to take all of this with a sort of grain of salt here. Extroverts are approachable and easily engaged by friends and strangers alike, though perhaps somewhat dominant in the conversation. Find telephone calls to be welcome interruptions. You don't hesitate to pick up the phone whenever you have something to tell someone. Like going to parties and prefer to talk with many people instead of just a few, an introvert will survive. Introverts will learn to survive at parties by grabbing onto one or two people over in the corner and cornering them for the evening. Your conversations aren't necessarily limited to those you already know, and you aren't beyond revealing relatively personal things to veritable strangers. You prefer generating ideas with a group than by yourself. You become drained if you spend too much time in reflective thinking without being able to bounce your thoughts off of others, where you see an introvert will love to just sit and what appears to an extrovert as wool gathering. They'll love to brood and think and reflect and so on and so forth. Find listening more difficult than talking. You don't like to give up the limelight and often get bored when you can't participate actively in a conversation. Extroverts, according to this, look with your mouth instead of your eyes. I lost my glasses. Has anyone seen my glasses? Who knows where my glasses are? Instead of the introvert, he'll go looking for their glasses. You know? And when you lose your train of thought, verbally find your way back. Now, what was I saying? I think it had something to do with last night's dinner. Oh yes, it was about what Harriet said, etc. Extroverts need affirmation from friends and associates about you who are about you are what you do, how you look, and just about everything else. You may think you're doing a good job, but until you hear someone tell you, you don't really truly believe it.
Is that an extrovert or an introvert?
Extrovert, yeah. Oh. Needs affirmation. An introvert, you see, if all's going well with you inside, the whole world can be burning down, and you're fine. On the other hand, if you're not okay inside, everything can actually be well outside, but as far as you're concerned, the whole world is burning down. Okay, now, an introvert. If you are an introvert, you probably rehearse things before saying them and prefer that others would do the same. You often respond with, I'll have to think about that, or let me tell you later, because you have to kind of work it through your system. Enjoy the peace and quiet of having time to yourself. You find your private time too easily invaded and tend to adapt by developing a high power of concentration that can shut out TV, noisy kids, or nearby conversations. That's really true with me. Sometimes Jeanette has to come and shake me to get my attention. You are perceived as a great listener. But feel others take advantage of you. Have been called shy from time to time. Whether or not you agree, you may come across to others as somewhat reserved and reflective. Like to share special occasions with just one other person or perhaps a few close friends. I should also add that all of us are both of these things. But we tend to prefer, again, we tend to prefer, have a natural preference for one or the other. And so you'll find that some of these categories will fit you and some won't. Anyway, wish that you could get your ideas out more forcefully. And you like stating your thoughts and feelings without interruption. And you allow others to do the same in the hope that they will reciprocate when it comes time for you to speak. Need to recharge alone after you spend time socializing with the group. The more intense the encounter, the greater the chance you'll feel drained afterward. We're told by your parents, go outside and play with your friends when you were a child. Your parents probably worried about you because you like to be by yourself. You often believe that talk is cheap and you get suspicious if people are too complimentary or irritated if they say something that's already been said by someone else. The phrase reinventing the wheel may occur to you as you hear others chattering away. Okay. This gets a little long here. We could go through each of these functions this way and talk about the characteristics of each one. And there's some wonderful books in the bookstore. Please Understand Me, as I know, in the bookstore. Prayer and Temperament, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, is in the bookstore. And other books that you can get. Now, many of you have taken the Myers-Briggs, and so you have a feel, perhaps, for your type. And so we're kind of ahead of the game in that way for those of you that do know something about that. Now, in this country, Americans love the Myers-Briggs type inventory because it's the one thing in Jung's psychology that can be quantified. And they quantify it, and there is correlations for psychological types and every vocation and glitch and preference and problem and that you can think of these days. What this all led to was that there ended up being 16 different types. You see, if you take one of the two attitudes and then decide which of these preferences you prefer, like S on this continuum or T on this continuum or the J or the P, then you end up with a type. My type is INFP. Or J, excuse me. I used to be P. But I've changed to J. There's a lot of reasons, which I won't go into, why that can happen to a person. Your type will change some. Although Jung claimed that it was basically set from the time you were born. Now, how does all this impact our spirituality? Another person came along and said, we can make this even simpler. Instead of 16 types, a man by the name of Kiersey came along and said that there are four temperaments. And they impact how we approach our own spirituality. And let me find my my page on that. Okay.
And the four four temperaments, he said these combinations of letters appear clearly more often than others. And so we have an SJ temperament, an SP temperament, or we have an NF temperament, or an NT temperament. And he said that depending on which of those temperaments you are, says a lot about who you are and how you approach your own spirituality. For example, and this is comes from a lecture that I gave to clergy in Paris about a year and a half ago. And so I was thinking mostly of these temperaments in relation to clergy, but I think it applies to everyone. So let me just read to you some of this work that I've done here. First of all, SP. Clergy, or SP people, and it's interesting that only 6% of the clergy are SP, and SP people are almost absent from our churches, even though they represent 38% of the U.S. population. That's interesting. SP clergy need to be engaged in activity. It is in the doing, not in the achieving, that their sense of fulfillment comes. Action is an end in itself, not a means to an end, as in other three temperaments. SP clergy are grounded in the senses. They want to be in direct contact with reality as it is experienced through taste, touch, smell, sight, and sound. SP clergy are down to earth and practical. They have little tolerance for the abstract. One of the reasons somebody suggested that SP people are not in church is because they don't like to sit still for an hour. They want to be doing something, and it just drives them crazy to have to sit there and, you know, give me a committee to work on, and a hammer and a saw, and or put me on a hotline, or in a crisis counseling situation, or, you know, but let's get something going here, and not just, now where are S people people found? They're found in charismatic churches, and places like that. They want possibilities that are real at this moment. They are impatient with static situations, theoretical discussions. That discussion last night would drive an SP person up the wall, I'm sure. You know, it did. They are impatient with static situations, theoretical discussions, or meetings that go nowhere. The variety of activity in an active parish, however, would appeal to an SP. An SP loves to get up in the morning and have the day happen to them. A few phone calls, a crisis or two, and they're off cooking. This is an SP's cup of tea. There is rarely a dull moment with these folks. Again, as I said, I was writing this for clergy, but it applies to us all. Parishioners come to value their SP pastor, particularly in times of need or crisis, and his or her willingness to get involved in the everyday issues of their lives. For SP, style is everything.
Style is having a 4-hour layover. Oh, this was my comment. Yeah. Style is having a 4-hour layover in an airport to visit your mother who lives only 50 miles away. An SP would love to pull that one off. An SP will stay up all night to put together a multimedia slide presentation of a recent congregational retreat complete with music. SP make great interim pastors. The worse the mess, the better. Because it allows them to live totally in the moment. Okay, well, you can translate that to some of your own preferences. Okay, let's talk about the NT person, or in this case, I was writing this for NT pastors. They represent about 12% of the clergy. Or 13%. Yeah, 13%. And about 12% of the U.S. population is NT. A very small percentage of the U.S. population is NT. And they are the intellectual, competence-seeking pastor. I have no idea what Walt Bowman's... I do, too, have an idea what Walt Bowman's type is. I mean, I don't know if he's taken the Myers. Are you here, Walter? No, he's not here.
Yes.
But I think it's pretty clear that Walter is a very strong NT person. I'd have to find out. But that would be my... I'd be very surprised if he wasn't. NTs gather data from their environment through intuition, through a search for meaning and possibilities. They make decisions about this data through logical linear analysis. These kinds of persons usually are visionaries. NTs, whether they're introverts or extroverts, tend to energize situations and provide strong leadership in whatever settings they find themselves. They are called by the ideal of truth and justice. They project competence. As a Bible study leader, they need to be at their best. In a pastoral crisis, they must be adept. In administration, they need to display superior skills. When preaching or teaching, they must be mind-blowing. They are always striving for excellence. Seminary is a haven for NT people. And of course, seminary professors are dominated by NT types. Largely, you have people teaching who are NT types. They're teaching people who are not NT types, but they are NT types. They are attracted to teaching, and they make excellent teachers because they think very clearly. And their spirituality tends to be academically and intellectually grounded. And New Testament clergy, or NT clergy, often New Testament, that's often begin their ministry in the parish by attempting to make the parish into a smaller version of the seminary community. So you can count on your NT pastor. You know, lots of courses and sermons will be very carefully thought out. And they are great preachers and teachers. They have a great capacity for words and concepts, and will challenge and inspire their congregations, both in worship and education. They will press parishioners hard on social justice and social consciousness issues. Because of the T, however, they're more interested in justice than they are in mercy. So getting it right is very important to an NT person, irrespective of how somebody else feels about it. And consequently, their downside is that they're usually in trouble a lot because they want you to get it right. They've struggled hard to get it right from their perspective, and they want you to get it right. Their intuition function allows them to envision a possible future for the parish. They like to rearrange their environment to make it more rational and effective. And they will bring to congregational life a systemic approach to growth and development. They value planning and goal setting. And they will judge themselves incompetent if their goals are not reached. The NT pastor will press the congregation towards excellence, and so forth. So that's the NT person. You could apply that to any of you in any of your professions, or the way in which you organize your life, and so forth. Okay, let's talk about the SJ person, or the SJ pastor. 38% of the people in the U.S. are SJ, and 32% of clergy are SJ.
So here are the general population percentages underneath.
Oh, all right.
I can only remember.
Want to do this? This is, we'll say clergy up here, okay?
Okay.
And population down here. SJ of the U.S. population is 38%. SP is 38%. These are 1988 statistics. I keep working on these things. And these NF is 12%, and NT is 12%. Those are approximate. And those, in all the research that's been done, those figures haven't varied very much. Now these are the people that are in Lutheran churches, SJs. A disproportionate, I wish I had those numbers. I rummaged desperately this morning to try to find those, and we need to get, there's a big thick book that's done all kinds of research. And the numbers for the clergy are pretty consistent across mainstream denominations. They're not, there's some differences in Roman Catholics. That's another issue. Okay, now the SJ person, who's this SJ person or clergy? That's the conserving, serving person or pastor. The SJ pastor is well grounded in reality, and they like to have their reality structured and ordered. SJs seek to belong and to serve and to nurture others. SJs, by the way, run most of the institutions in our country. Holden is one exception. We have a hard time getting SJs in here. They like to be the nurturing parent and naturally offer concrete, practical ways to assist those in pain, need, or distress. They are the most authority-dependent of all the types. They may complain about what they're being forced to endure, but they will go along with it. They're very loyal. The SJ personality is very loyal. SJ pastors will focus on the rich heritage of the past. They like to emphasize the fundamentals of religion, attempting to impart to people a simple faith with practical down-to-earth rules for living. SJ clergy tend to be the most traditional of all clergy temperaments, bringing stability and continuity in whatever situation they are called to serve. They will be loyal to denominational liturgies and doctrines. Congregations that stray too far from denominational policies, procedures, and doctrines will find themselves being brought back to the fold by their SJ pastor. SJ clergy know how to work a system to bring necessary change. NT, which we haven't talked about yet, clergy, can best envision the changes. What?
NF. We talked about NT.
Okay. That's right. NF and NT, actually, can best envision the changes that need to occur in the parish. But the SJ clergy are the ones who can bring it off and make it happen. Congregations will not go through unnecessary changes under their SJ clergy. What is tried, tested, and true will be preserved. They tend to be driven by a lot of inner shoulds and oughts. SJ clergy will communicate to others a sense of social, moral, and spiritual obligations. They want to be needed, desire to serve, like being obligated to work best with people who come at life with a similar motivation. SJs are super dependable people. They seldom make errors and tend to be outstanding at precision work. They will run an efficient meeting and will usually work from an ordered, planned agenda. They bring superior skills to administrative functions. Children and older people will be taken care of especially well. SJ clergy will make sure that children and youth are taught the basics of the faith in a very neat, discernible, clear, orderly classroom manner. And old people will be listened to and respected by SJ clergy. We find the lowest clergy divorce rate amongst SJ clergy. Even when their marriages falter, SJs feel very deeply the importance of vows they have made, and they will honor them and continue to work at it better than any of the other temperaments. SJs want the best for the church and its members. They spend wisely. They give to others what they deny themselves. They can be a frugal Spartan lot, but they will be regal for God. A committed SJ can't do anything second rate. If it's a stained glass windows, they need to be leaded. If it's carpeted for the sanctuary, it needs to be of the highest quality. Worship will tend to be formal and dignified. Musical selections will reflect the theme of the day. Liturgies will be predictable, and traditions in worship will be established and followed. As I have said, 60 to 80% of Lutherans who are members of Lutheran congregations will be SJ temperaments. That's the SJ. Now finally we come to the NF. And this is the interesting.
50%.
12% of the population are NFs, 50% of the clergy are NFs. 80% of the congregation are an SJ. These clergy have all been taught by NTs. And so you can see where the confusion sets in. One out of every two clergy in mainline Protestant churches is NF. Yet only 12% of the population is made up of this temperament. And I can't tell you, and I would guess about the same percentage of the people in the congregation are that temperament. Those that have studied clergy call this the authenticity-seeking, relationship-oriented pastor. NFs search for authenticity, for their deeper self. Their natural desire to seek for self-actualization and individuation. Given this built-in quest, it is not too surprising that many end up taking the spiritual route to find their deepest sense of who they are. INFs are, of course, the natural mystics. Their search goes on in solitude, internally, and there they run into God. ENFs want to do their searching in the context of human community. One of the interesting struggles that goes on at Holden all the time is this defining of community as individuals in community, and to what extent the community shapes the individual, and to what extent the individual shapes the community, and so on and so forth. NFs are the most idealistic and romantic of the four temperaments. They are attracted to helping roles and dealing with human suffering. They are the most likely candidates to take on low-paying, the impossible role of being a resident religious authority. Given the virtual loss of viable monastic communities in this century, the parish ministry appeals to many NFs as the best place to find spiritual journeyers. As opposed to some religious orders of the past, now we NFs, of course, can get married and even earn a salary as we continue our endless search for authenticity. NF clergy perceive the world as possibilities and want to translate those possibilities as interpersonal and intrapersonal realities for themselves. When they look out on their congregations, they can always see the possibilities in terms of relationships and growth opportunities. How NF's function of ministry is unpredictable because it is tied to the role models that they've idealized for themselves. If their heroes in ministry are tender, loving authorities, they will reflect this. If their heroes are tough-minded clergy, they will reflect this. They will model their ministry after the role most significant to them at the moment. So if you have an NF pastor, he may go away to a conference and come back with a whole new program for the life of the church. So you've got to be careful about sending them away. They may switch to another role model for deeply personal reasons and begin a whole new style of ministry. NF clergy are very flexible and unpredictable. They are caught between trying to please people important to them and being true to their own drive for authenticity. The F side, you see, if that's a preferred function in a person, the person who has a well-developed F wants to know how people are feeling about whatever they've done or they said. They want you to feel good, or you want other. If you're F, you want others to feel good. You'll even back off on your own convictions or anything else to make sure that everybody feels okay about things. They're more on the side of mercy, less on the side of justice. NF clergy may never come to peace with authority. Where authority is concerned, NFs experience more lifelong misery than any other type. NF clergy are also the most susceptible to projections from parishioners. They have a tremendous need to rescue hurting people. All of you NFs do. You just love to rescue people. And we forget that there was only one Savior and we ain't it. And we feel very guilty if our rescue efforts fail when we've tried to rescue someone. Thus, they take on all expectations. If someone wants them to be strong, then they'll be strong. If someone wants them to be free and loose, they can be free and loose. When they are with conservative members, they'll put on their most conservative face. They are the most capable of being all things to all people in order that they might rescue someone. When fully developed, NF clergy normally have high interpersonal intragroup competence. Their intuitive preference works with their feeling preference, giving them the capacity to intuit what other people are going through. A well-developed NF can sense what you're going through. They can pick up on personal pain the way radar picks up on airplanes. They will be high on inspiration and low on the practical, down-to-earth, nuts and bolts aspects of ministry. If you got an NF pastor, make sure you got some SJs around, or the whole place may fall down. That's just a word about NF. Now, these temperaments are interesting because as research has gone on about psychological types and then about temperaments, we've discovered that different temperaments prefer and find meaningful different kinds of worship experiences. That they seek out and prefer different kinds of prayer life. This is a very interesting book called Prayer and Temperament. And it suggests that there is a totally different style of prayer that each of these temperaments find meaningful. So one kind of prayer life will not appeal to all four all four temperaments. And then it goes through and it talks about each of these, the Augustinian style, the Franciscan style, the Thomas style.
Who's that book by?
This is by two authors, Chester Michael and Marie Norzi. And this one is in the bookstore. Here's another little interesting chart that someone developed. Talks about following your spiritual path or finding your spiritual path, and for example, on the issue of prayer, a person who has a highly developed extroversion will tend to prefer more corporate prayer styles. Obviously, somebody with more developed introversion will develop private. Somebody that's got a strong S function prefers, according to this chart, sensuous ears, nose, hands, mouth, something that involves the senses, or the intuitive person, where they can use their intuition in their prayer life. A thinking person obviously likes ideas and a more cognitive style, and so forth. I was trying to find the one here on worship. Windows through which God's revelation is received. The extroverted person, people, events, scripture, natural world. The introverted person, individual experience, inspiration, inner world. A strong S function, society, institutions, the scene. And the intuitive person, insight, imagination, the unseen. Thinking person, windows, we're talking about windows through which God is perceived, reason and speculation. The F person, through relationships and their own personal emotions. If they have a strong J function, then they want good order, like to their worship service. And if they have a strong P, then they prefer serendipity and spontaneity in their worship life. Well, let's quit. What I'm suggesting to you today is that we're all different, and our different personality types and our temperaments suggest to us that there may be, we may find ourselves trying to approach our own spiritual journey from a perspective that's not natural to us. Or it would be helpful for us to think about what is natural for us, and how can we find ways that are supportive of how we just naturally like to work and be in our journey with God.